Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review, also the author of The Weed Agency. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for all of you as usual. We start with the good, and it's a breaking story out of a three-judge panel on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals. The case is Halbig versus Burwell. She's now the HHS secretary. The issue at hand in this case is language inside the Affordable Care Act that says that only subsidies can be given through plans purchased on state exchanges. But since 36 of those states opted out of the exchange, they're on the federal exchange, and therefore subsidies obtained through the federal exchange are not in keeping with the law. So those subsidies would be ruled illegal. Obviously, this will be appealed to the full D.C. Circuit, probably certainly to the Supreme Court. So, Jim, there's a lot of legal wrangling to go here, but if you take away the subsidies, the appeal of Obamacare becomes even more hard to find.
If this decision were to stay all the way through the judicial process, this would be a huge, perhaps a hammer strike to the heart of Obamacare and maybe make it completely non-functional to the point where even Democrats would have to repeal it. But there's a couple challenges here. The first is that, if you don't have the subsidies, insurance is really expensive. And a whole bunch of people who were forced to buy insurance because of the mandate would then say, wait a minute, I don't want to buy this. This is way too expensive. And, the government's not giving it to me, at least in the states that have not set up exchanges. It's going to go to the full D.C. circuit. And there's right now 7-4 in terms of Democratic-appointed judges versus Republican-appointed judges. The suspicion is that, those judges will just say, all right, Democrats, what do you need? Okay, you got it. No problem. We'll take care of that decision for you. And then it goes up to the Supreme Court, and then we kind of depend on what side of the bed Kennedy got out of bed that morning.
Or Roberts.
Or Roberts for that matter. And as somebody said when they heard this, a chill went down Roberts' spine because they're assuming this goes all the way up to the Supreme Court, which seems like a very safe bet. Then once again, John Roberts is going to have a very big decision before him, which is, does he make a decision that a lot of liberals will not like and demonize him as this crazy right-wing extremist who's destroying the reputation of the Supreme Court, the worst justice since Torquemada. Or he can give them what they want, in which he'll be considered the wisest statesman since Hammurabi, all kind of stuff. And it's feast or famine for him. The Supreme Court's basically going to get a second bite at the apple, a second to make that decision on the mandate. It seems like a circumstance in which the text of the law is not all that disputable. And that these two judges kind of were saying reluctantly, they don't like all the headaches and chaos that's going to come out of this decision. But on the other hand, what the law says is pretty clear, and you can't expect the judges to rewrite the law because you weren't careful in writing it. The flip side is that the Democrats say, well, look, we know what we meant. Isn't that good enough? And short answer is no, not really. So we'll see what happens from this. At least short-lived, a very big-time victory for opponents of Obamacare. And then the next question will be whether the Supreme Court sees it this way some point down the road.
Very interesting. And certainly this is the win that conservatives needed in this case, because if the three-judge panel had rejected it, it's hard to think that the Supremes would have taken it straight from there, perhaps. It's hard to know for sure. But this basically guarantees it'll get to the Supreme Court no matter what happens at the full D.C. circuit. So on to the bad martini now, and this is from the Morning Jolt this morning, and how Chinese-made bicycles could impact the Wisconsin governor's race. Scott Walker, of course, running for re-election, his Democratic opponent, Mary Burke. Her family owns a bicycle company. Recently, there's been a lot of the business shipped over to China, although there's certainly a significant part that's still in Wisconsin. And she's dodging questions over whether the Chinese workers there are being paid far less than the minimum wage and all sorts of other things about outsourcing. Jim, you've obviously looked at this in great detail. Is this something that's going to make Mary Burke look like a hypocrite or Scott Walker look like he's against capitalism?
To me, the most interesting angle is how kind of blatantly hypocritical Burke is being. Because, one, this goes back quite a few years. Yes, she doesn't work at this bicycle company now, but she worked at it earlier in her career. She still owns plenty of stock in this family company. So, the best defense you can make is that she herself is not responsible for the outsourcing decisions. She just profits from them, which, your average union member or other, progressive in Wisconsin is not going to like to hear too much. Now, the flip side of this is that, the Walker campaign is whacking her for outsourcing. adding to the narrative that outsourcing is something that only bad corporate companies do, and that obviously it's done out of greed and a desire to exploit foreign labor, although actually it is done to exploit foreign labor. I think we could argue whether that's, you know, as you said, driven by the forces of the market or represents some sort of awful moral compromise. But I posted this morning, been a lot of pushback from a lot of conservative readers who are saying, wait a minute, whoa, I like Scott Walker, but this is using the whole stuff that they used against Mitt Romney here. To which point I say, yes, and it worked. if you expect a Republican who has the opportunity to paint a Democrat as a, you know, callous outsourcer not to take that shot, I think your expectations for modern politics are kind of unrealistic. You know, the Republican will do that 6 days a week and twice on Sundays because it works, because, you know, the public is already convinced outsourcing is something that evil corporations do. Now, should the public maybe have a more nuanced or complicated perspective on outsourcing? Yeah, I guess that'd be nice to have that, a better understanding of free market economics and the value of international trade. But to be honest, like, you know, a couple months out from a really hard-fought gubernatorial campaign is not the time to be running economics 101. You know, if the public thinks outsourcing is bad and your opponent is tied to outsourcing, you nail her on it, or you can lose. You know, those are your options there. So on the one hand, I kind of feel like everybody's giving Walker, the Walker campaign, a little too much grief over this. But I guess I can see, you know, there's some, the folks who would say, wait a minute, if we stay, you know, we are being awfully convenient in our application of our principles and our ideas of what kind of policies we think are right. So I'm open to both perspectives, Greg, but I think it's a little unrealistic to think that Walker should not, you know, swing this 2x4 at her kneecap when he has the opportunity.
Well, that's certainly part of her major campaign platform, as you point out in the Jolt and in the campaign spot today. The living wage, raising the minimum wage, is a major factor. So it does definitely tie into some of the things that she's trying to advocate or claim she advocates for. So it certainly is fair game, but you do have to be careful when you're going to use it, because then it becomes less outrageous when the Democrats do it back to you the next time. So, all right, on to the crazy martini. And Jim, this is going to really catch you by surprise. According to a new book by Ronald Kessler, he is the one who has written on the Secret Service before. He's got a new book out called The First Family Detail. It's basically things that Secret Service agents have told him during their time in protecting various first families. I hope you're sitting down, but it turns out Bill Clinton allegedly has a mistress. I know that's going to take you completely by surprise. Apparently, she's a buxom blonde. She's known as the Energizer, and she's there in Chappaqua so frequently that she doesn't even have to go through the normal security protocols. And Bill's detail and Hillary's detail are in touch, so Bill always knows ahead of time when Hillary's coming home, and so he can have the Energizer clear out. So this isn't exactly something that's going to stun a lot of people, but it is a good reminder that if you bring back the Clintons, you bring back everything about the Clintons.
Yeah, I'm going to have a couple of perhaps surprising reactions here, Greg. The first is I'm kind of a little unnerved about Secret Service agents talking to reporters or authors about the people they protect outside of perhaps a criminal, you know, investigation or something like that. I mean, I just kind of feel like, you know, your job is to protect the person. Your job is not necessarily to be the eyes and ears. If we're going to complain about the NSA invading our privacy, I'm not so sure I like the idea of Secret Service agents kissing and telling or watching the kissing and the telling. In the report that it's a buxom blonde, Greg, I do have to say I am glad that there's a little bit of diversity in the women that Bill Clinton is going on. Early on in his administration, you may recall, he talked about the importance of having a harem that looks like America. Women of every race, creed, and hue in the same positions. I'm sorry, it's cabinet. I'm sorry, but you get the idea. You know. Again, nobody's going to be terribly surprised by this. I suppose you can argue that, look, as a technically private citizen, this is not nearly as much of the public concern as it was when he was banging an intern in the Oval Office. On the other hand, in normal circumstances, having the spouse of, say, the Secretary of State having an affair would be opportunity for blackmail and would be something that's problematic. I do have to wonder about the foreign power that attempted to blackmail Bill Clinton by revealing that he was having an affair. Oh, no, my reputation will be ruined. You know, that was a really bad Bill Clinton impression, by the way. You get the idea that, on the one hand, you know, Bill Clinton philandering is kind of priced in. I think you are right that these kind of stories make you say, oh, here we go again with these folks. Not the most flattering aspect of the Clintons, and you know, there's not an enormous. There's quite a bit of competition for that title. But anyway, so there we are. Not that surprising. More of a cringe-inducing crazy opportunity today.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we'll leave it at that, which is probably safe for everyone. Jim, we'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join us Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.